The 4th District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Peter C. Kavanaugh presiding.
Good afternoon. We'll call case number 4-23-1162, the people of the state of Illinois versus Philip Anglin. Counsel for the appellant, will you please state your name?
Allison Golish.
Thank you. And for the appellee?
Jamie Bella.
Thank you. Ms. Golish, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Allison Golish, and I represent Mr. Philip Anglin in this appeal. Today, I will focus on issues one, two, and four: the sufficiency issue, counsel's ineffectiveness for failing to impeach the confidential informant, Seth Rich, and the sentencing errors. I do not plan to discuss issue three, but I'm prepared to answer questions on that issue. Beginning with issue one, the evidence was insufficient to prove Mr. Anglin was guilty of delivery of a controlled substance, as there was no delivery between Anglin and Rich in this case. The statute defines delivery as the transfer of possession of a controlled substance. People versus Kidd in the Second District lets us know that the mere physical transfer of a controlled substance does not necessarily qualify as a legal delivery under the statute. This is because if two or more people jointly and simultaneously possess a substance, regardless of whether that possession is actual or constructive possession, then there can be no delivery between those people. This is.
Counsel, I have some questions for you about your argument that the prosecutor's argument was improper and reversible error. And am I correct that we're asked to review that as plain error because no objection was made?
You are correct, Your Honor, for that first part of the argument that there was a misstatement of the law. The misstatement of the fact was.
So we have to find the error. Was clear or obvious for plain error to apply. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Did the parties stipulate in this case that the substance the police recovered was more than 15 grams of cocaine?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So we know a crime was committed and the car that was stopped in which the cocaine was found. Was the defendant and Seth Rich, and who is the third party?
The third party was a man named Mauricio. There's not a lot of information in the record about him, but
Okay.
he was the backseat passenger.
Would it be correct to say on this evidence that either the defendant or Mr. Rich committed this crime?
Based on this evidence, the possession of the cocaine would be any of the three in the car.
Well, it's in other words, it's one of those two, isn't that?
Your Honor,
We know a crime has been committed, and based upon the testimony of the defendant and the testimony of Mr. Rich, it's one of those two who committed the crime, isn't that right?
because Seth Rich is a confidential informant in this case, his possession of the cocaine would not be a commission of a crime.
According to your client, however, he's the person who had the cocaine and wasn't your client who committed the crime. Isn't that right?
Correct. The person that delivered that committed the delivery offense in this case would be the Yorkville dealer. If we're talking about simple possession of the cocaine, then based on the evidence and the issues in this case, we would say that there would need to be a new trial to determine possession and the facts there because of the way that the trial errors impacted the trial.
And your client testified, and he explained how, in his view, what happened and how he wasn't guilty of anything. And essentially, this was a setup by Mr. Rich. Is that right?
Correct, Your
Okay. In arguing that prosecutor's closing argument was improper, you cite the Yonker case in from the First District and the Yonker case has these two quotes in it. First is from people for Pecoraro, which Yonker says this. In that case, the prosecutor told the jury that if it found defendant was not guilty, it was finding that the state's witnesses were unbelievable. The court held that because the defendant's version of the events differed considerably from the state's, the comments were not prejudicial. Does that apply in this case, that in your client's version of events differ considerably from the state's?
It does, Your Honor.
And is it permissible under these circumstances for the state to argue that your client was not believable?
It is permissible for the state to argue that my client was not believable, that Mr. Allen wasn't. However, it's not permissible for them to tie that credibility determination to guilt, which they did several times throughout the closing argument and rebuttal.
Now, here's the other quote from Younger. It quoted the Supreme Court decision of People v. Phillips, saying this: "This court has never said or implied that once a defendant does present certain evidence, it is beyond the reach of appropriate comment by the prosecution. There's a great deal of difference between an allegation by the prosecution that the defendant did not prove himself innocent and statements questioning the relevance or credibility of a defendant's case. Not every prosecutorial statement questioning relevance or credibility rises to an impermissible shifting of the burden. Was there any claim in this case by the prosecutor that the defendant did not prove himself innocent?"
Yes, Your Honor.
The prosecutor used those words?
He said, "But think of where Seth Rich's mind was at and the perspective he had again. In order to believe this defendant, to find him not guilty, you would have to believe that Seth Rich framed this defendant and somehow pulled one over on all the police in their efforts as well." That's on page
so
24
that,
of the
that's
record.
you're saying that the prosecutor argued that the defendant had to prove himself innocent?
I'm saying that the prosecutor argued that you have to believe the defense theory of the case in order to find him not guilty.
Isn't that in fact true?
No, Your Honor. You can
Well,
find
now let me go ahead and see. That's why I asked the questions in the order I did. If the jury doesn't believe the defendant's version of events, then how are they going to find him not guilty, given he
Because, Your
chose
Honor,
to testify, given his rather odd story?
Because, Your Honor, there could be more than one person that the jury doesn't believe in this case. The jury could not believe Mr. England, but it could also not believe Seth Rich. Or it could believe Seth Rich, but not beyond a reasonable doubt, and find that the state proved his case beyond a reasonable doubt. This case doesn't hinge on the credibility of Mr. England, my client. It hinges on the credibility of Rich. So if
Why
they
didn't
have...
it? That is, if your client chooses to testify, why can't the jury look at his testimony and view him as an abject liar, insulting their intelligence with his cock and bull story? And why can't the jury, based upon that, in consideration of all the other evidence in this case, find them guilty?
Your Honor, the burden doesn't shift to the defendant just because the defendant chooses to testify. The jury
Even when he
still
lies?
has to... Excuse me?
Even when he lies and the jury
Even
says...
when he lies, he can be a liar and still not guilty of delivery in this case. Both things could be true.
So it's improper for the state to point out he's lying?
It is not improper for the state to point out he's lying, Your Honor. It is improper to say because he's lying, that means you have to find him guilty. That's not the burden.
In your brief, you quote some of the state's argument as follows. So to believe this defendant... So, to believe this defendant, believe that Seth Rich framed him for this event occurring on November 28th, and this defendant's role in that event, I would argue, is not reasonable. Is that a permissible argument?
It isn't a permissible argument if the state, as it did in this case, started by
counsel,
saying the burden is...
Counsel, I choose my words carefully. Let me
I
repeat
understand.
My question. Is it a permissible argument to say... So to believe this defendant, believe that Seth Rich framed him for this event occurring on November 28th and this defendant's role in that event, I would argue is not reasonable. Is that
Yes, Your
improper?
Honor. That alone would be permissible argument, but it
Okay.
has to be taken
But
within...
then the next sentence following it is, and I would ask that you reject that argument and find him guilty. The following sentence makes the previous one improper.
The following and the preceding sentence within that rebuttal, taken in the context of the whole rebuttal, which this court must do, the state says that the burden here is proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It then says nothing the defendant said was reasonable. Therefore, you should reject the defense theory of the case and find him guilty. All of those things in conjunction are burden shifting, and that's the issue in this case. We
Well,
can't
in the
keep
cases
isolated
talking
speakers.
about burden shifting, for instance, the primary case, the Supreme Court case, Banks, didn't testify. Doesn't the defendant testifying and coming up with this ridiculous story change the evaluation so that the prosecutor would really have to say he didn't meet his burden of proof before the argument becomes improper?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that I understand your question, but I would maintain that a defendant testifying doesn't change the burden of proof, which is on the state.
Go ahead.
Counsel, just to preserve time, you've done a fine job answering the questions. I understand your position, burden shifting. But did you want to, at this point, discuss the failure to object timely?
The failure to object timely.
With regard to the misstatement?
No, Your Honor.
From the prosecutor?
We raised it under first prong plain error, so we contend that it is closely balanced in this
Okay.
case because everything turns on Rich's.
Okay. Yeah. You're right. Continue. I'm sorry.
No worries. Thank you, Your Honor. If I may return to argument one, if there are no further questions on issue three. So here, as we were discussing, the rule is that if there are two or more people that are jointly and simultaneously possessing a substance, then there can be no delivery between them. You can't re-deliver to someone who already has possession. And that's why there was no delivery in this case and the conduct should be reduced to the lesser included. It's because both parties, Rich and England, jointly and simultaneously possessed the cocaine at the outset. And so there could be no delivery between the two of them. If there are no questions on that issue, I can turn briefly to issue two. Issue two, counsel was ineffective in failing to cross-examine Rich on his 2023 methamphetamine charge. The state agrees that Rich's testimony was critical in this case, highlighting that Rich was the only witness that claimed the dealer handed the cocaine directly to England. Yet the state claims it was reasonable for the defense counsel to forego impeaching Rich with his pending methamphetamine charge because that would open the door for the state to rehabilitate Rich with his prior consistent statement. We would just point out that this argument misunderstands the facts for two main reasons. First, nowhere in the police report that the state cites to on common law record page 113 and 114 does it state that Rich told the police the dealer handed the cocaine directly to England. In fact, the police report is entirely silent about England's alleged possession of the cocaine. So accepting that this critical fact, whether or not England was ever in actual possession of the cocaine, it was the determining fact in this case, and the credibility of Rich is critical here. Counsel should have presented evidence that he had an additional 2023 methamphetamine charge in order to establish a motive to lie, a bias, an interest. That didn't happen here, and that was unreasonable assistance in this case. Second, even if those statements were in the police report or there was anything in the police report that could be used to rebut this presumption, this wouldn't be inconsistent with defense counsel's theory, which was that Rich from the beginning was trying to manufacture some sort of drug deal in order to receive leniency in his own case. And this additional 2023 case would be further supporting evidence to counsel's theory. The impeachment value of that was significant, and any diminishing of that from any prior consistent statements would not have been such that it would have been unreasonable to bring that forward. As such, counsel was ineffective for failing to use the pending methamphetamine charge to impeach Seth Rich. If there are no questions on that argument, I will conclude with the issue four, the sentencing issue. So lastly, as to issue four, the 30-year sentence in this case that was imposed was excessive. There are three main reasons, as we discussed in the brief, that resulted in an excessive sentence in this case. First, it was disproportionate to the conduct in this case, which was Mr. England handing his friend a small bag of cocaine. The most important factor is the seriousness of the offense. This is well established. Here, the court did not properly take into account the nature of the offense when imposing this sentence. The legislator already accounted for the seriousness of a delivery offense generally when it created it as a class X for this range of cocaine. The circuit court has to fashion an appropriate sentence within that range, but the legislator made it clear in their legislative intent statement that the higher end of the range should be for these bigger drug traffickers who are trafficking frequently in these big amounts. And to the extent this court doesn't agree with issue one, at the very most, Mr. England here was an occasional petty distributor. who the legislature says should have a sentence that's more on the lower end of the range. An offense, it's significant to note that offense is not the statutory offense in the abstract, but it's the offense as committed by the defendant. It's the particular facts and circumstances of the defendant's conduct. And here the conduct was him going with this confidential informant to pick up drugs from someone who was other than him, who was the dealer, who was the one that ended up with the money, not Mr. Anglin. The court also took it one step further, not only failing to consider the actual conduct in this case, but then considering facts that were not in evidence by saying that Mr. Anglin was, quote, harming the whole community, bringing drugs back into this community. There's no evidence to establish that these drugs were going to go anywhere in the community. There's no evidence to establish that Anglin intended them to go anywhere in the community. And in fact, they end up with the police, not with the community. So it was improper to enhance his sentence on this basis. I would point this court to People versus Daly, which deals with an analogous issue about using facts that are not actually part of the conviction in order to enhance the sentence. Third and lastly, the court did not consider the fact that Rich induced and facilitated this offense, which is a statutory mitigating factor. This is also the point where I think counsel's ineffectiveness at the sentencing hearing is most obvious. She says that there are no mitigating factors in this case, but it's apparent from the facts that Rich asked Anglin to help him set him up with Anglin's dealer. Rich then drove them to the drug deal. He supplied the money for the cocaine. So it was a conduct that was induced and facilitated by another person. That factor should have been considered by the court. And the court, in saying there were not many mitigating factors, in fact, the only one that she found was his addiction, which she didn't consider a mitigating factor, is affirmative evidence in the record rebutting any sort of presumption that she did consider the proper mitigating factors in this case. So the court failed to consider the nature of the offense, especially when evaluating the aggravating and mitigating factors. It then imposed an excessive sentence because of that. Counsel's failure to bring this to the court's attention, correct these misconceptions, and argue this factor in mitigation was deficient performance, prejudicing Mr. Anglin. And as such, this court should either reduce Mr. Anglin's sentence as permitted under Rule 615B or remand for a new sentencing hearing with competent counsel. Just by way of brief review, since there are a lot of issues here in this case, just to kind of recap. First, the evidence was insufficient to prove Mr. Anglin delivered the cocaine, and his offense should be reduced to the lesser included offense. That's a class one for possession of a controlled substance. Second, counsel was ineffective for failing to impeach Rich with his 2023 methamphetamine charge, and thus Anglin should receive a new trial on that lesser included offense. This would not be in the alternative situation. Third, as discussed in the briefs and thoroughly with Justice Steigman at the outset of this argument, the prosecution's misstatements of the law in this case and the facts deprived Mr. Anglin of a fair trial. And finally, Mr. Anglin's sentence was excessive and should be reduced or remanded for a new sentencing hearing. If your honors have no further questions, I can wait to respond to any of the state's points in rebuttal.
Okay, hearing no questions, y'all have time in rebuttal. Counsel for the appellee.
Good afternoon, your honors. May it please the court. My name is Jamie Bella on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. There are four issues in this case. I would like to begin first with the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, primarily because the issue in or the first issue regarding the Coots case plays a role in the other three issues as far as the arguments as they're set forth by the defendant in his brief. So turning to the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel, the state's position regarding this issue is that this was not ineffective assistance of counsel because primarily in the first position, the decision itself regarding whether to impeach a witness is considered a matter of trial strategy. And in failing to overcome the presumption that the attorney's conduct was objectively reasonable, the fact that the particular strategy that the defendant argues counsel was ineffective for failing to pursue, as far as impeaching Rich, the confidential informant, with his 2023 arrest for drug delivery, I believe, was ineffective because it would have shown a motive to fabricate his testimony. However, because that arrest in particular happened after the arrest in this case, any statement that Rich made on the day of the arrest when he spoke to the police and debriefed them after the traffic stop would have given the state grounds to move to admit his prior consistent statement, which would have further supported Rich's testimony and enhanced his credibility in that sense. So to undertake that type of strategy would not have been consistent with the objectively reasonable standard. I understand counsel's argument that in the reply brief that the statement would not have been admissible because Rich's motive to lie predated his statement to police. That argument in the reply brief is different, however, from the argument that the motivation to lie in his testimony was because of this 2023 conviction or arrest. It was not a conviction. But because that particular arrest happened after he made the statement to police, that prior consistent statement would have been admissible. The defendant's reply brief argues that the actual motivation to lie now is his service as a confidential informant, which began in 2020. And that then brings up a relevance question of what the 2023 arrest has to do with his service as a confidential informant, when his arrest at that time, back in 2020, is what led to his desire and an actual service becoming a confidential informant in the first place. So his act of becoming a confidential informant was motivated by his 2020 arrest. Philip Anglin was arrested in 2022. The 2023 arrest wouldn't have motivated his desire to become a confidential informant. But if that arrest had motivated his desire to remain a confidential informant or to gain additional leverage, it wouldn't have been in relation to the statement that he made at trial, because that statement was memorialized in the officer's report in 2020, 4 months before that arrest even occurred. So it's impossible, just as a matter of pure logic, that he was motivated by something that happened 4 months later on the day of the arrest on November 28th, 2022. So that 4 month difference, it kind of dispenses with the idea that there was any grounds to argue that his arrest in 2023 motivated a lie at trial. In the defendant's opening brief, it is actually structured, the way it's presented is the arrest or the 2023 arrest of Rich happened in March 27th of 2023, and his trial testimony was on June 20th, 2023. So the testimony happened after the arrest. But then in the reply brief, the argument then changes character to become, no, the motivation was actually not the arrest, it was his being a CI. So I think that is waived. However, even if that specific argument were to be considered on its merits, the defendant's reliance in the reply brief on the McWhite case doesn't help, because in that case, the particular impeachment that defense counsel pursued was an impeachment by omission. But the trial court, in ruling and granting the state's request to offer a prior consistent statement, when the judge allowed it, the judge said that it was a prior consistent statement intended to rebut the charge of fabricated testimony, which was unrelated to what the defense counsel, in offering that evidence in the first place, was pursuing. So the court on review looked at the specific testimony and then the prior consistent statement. The consistent statement was made during the preliminary hearing and in other arrest reports, but in the vice report itself, which was used at trial by defense counsel to do an impeachment by omission, said that the police observed the defendant retrieve drugs from a barbecue grill. So
in this case, what would be the downside from the defense counsel's attempting to elicit information about the arrest?
In this case, or in the McWhite case? In this case, the 2023 arrest happened after Rich debriefed the police officers when they arrested the defendant. And that statement was memorialized in the officer's report. So by impeaching Rich and bringing up his 2023 arrest during his testimony, he would have if counsel had pursued that, then the state would have then tried to admit the officer's report showing that prior to this arrest, he made the same statement. By doing that, by now that statement itself, the arrest report and the statement, the prior consistent statement, would have been inadmissible because it can't be offered to support the testimony of Rich at trial. But if counsel had raised the charge of a recent fabrication by arguing or presenting evidence and impeaching him with the conviction, in order specifically, the defendant's argument is that she should have done that for the specific purpose of establishing that Rich was motivated to lie. So by saying he was motivated to lie because of this 2023 arrest, then the state showing the arrest report that happened before the arrest, where the statement was similar, would have, first of all, allowed the state grounds to admit that statement. And that statement would have supported Rich's testimony and offered, would support his credibility in his statement and then bolster his testimony. So
from the point of view of the defendant, wouldn't those circumstances have served to dirty up Rich somewhat, maybe in the eyes of the jury?
Yes, and I believe, and that's the kind of the crux of the defendant's argument, is that counsel should have done that in order to dirty up Rich. But in the act of doing that, would have given the state or opened the door for the state to rehabilitate him with his prior consistent statement, which would have then
demonstrate that he's not as dirty as the defense is trying to show.
At least, right, and to the extent that there's any evidence that he's dirty, it wasn't related to this 2023 arrest. And the record shows that the counsel wasn't just unaware of the statement, because the defendant, even in his post-trial, in his pro se motion, the one that he filed himself after trial, specifically pointed out that he wrote on a yellow pad in front of counsel repeatedly to bring up this 2023 arrest. So it's not that counsel wasn't aware, overlooked it, or neglected the case. It was simply she chose to not pursue that testimony. And that's the kind of a trial strategy decision that rests with defense counsel. And in order to overcome that, the presumption that she was acting reasonably, it's kind of a high bar to get over. And I think just the fact that she didn't bring it up does not get over that bar. And if the fact that he was a confidential informant somehow motivated a lie, that evidence was already in trial. Rich had already testified at that point that he was serving as a confidential informant, that his service as a confidential informant began with an arrest in 2022. And the defense counsel questioned him about, or I think maybe the state questioned Rich specifically about whether he was offered anything in return for his testimony. And he said no. Now, if counsel had gone a step further and tried to bring in this 2023 statement, it wouldn't have disrupted any of that other evidence, but it would have given the state grounds to bring in some serious support evidence of Rich's testimony, which would only have bolstered it. Even if there could be an argument that she could have done either, the question in ineffective assistance of counsel is whether any reasonable attorney would decline to pursue the strategy counsel. And I don't think it's reasonable that you couldn't find attorneys that would say that's not a smart decision. And they would be justified in saying that, because allowing the state, or even giving the state an attempt to bring in this prior consistent statement to bolster Rich's testimony, would have been unreasonable. She could have taken that risk, but I think the fact that it's a risk, maybe the judge would have overruled the state's attempt to bring in that prior consistent statement, but that would have been a risky move on counsel's part. And it was not ineffective assistance of counsel for her to opt not to go down that path. So I think for those reasons, the state would request that this court decline to find that counsel was ineffective for not pursuing this particular arrest. And if there are no questions with regard to that issue too, then I would move on to the first issue regarding the element of delivery. So the defendant's position is that there is no evidence that there was a delivery in this case, because essentially that they were in joint possession. So he was a joint possessor, not a deliverer. And because Rich and defendant went to Yorkville together, they were in Rich's car. The cocaine was purchased from the car, and both the defendant and Rich were inside the car. So because of those reasons, then the then both parties jointly and simultaneously acquired the cocaine. And the defendant relies on the Coots case. I think it's important to note some of the distinctions and similarities with the Coots case that don't support this argument. So in Coots, this was a the defendant's friend was found dead in a hotel room due to the effects of consuming heroin. The evidence showed that they got together, spent the night at the hotel. The next day, they left together in a taxi and went to an ATM machine. And then they returned back to the hotel. The taxi driver then picked the defendant up later alone, and then they left. But the defendant, in her statement to police, said that when the dealer brought the cocaine, she put it in her pocket. She gave the victim, Cawthon, one bag of heroin. He took the heroin, but then was complaining that he wasn't high enough and he wanted to do more. But the defendant told the police that she was not planning, when he began to ask her for more of the heroin, she refused to give it to him and had it in her pocket. But eventually, because the victim continued to pester her about more of the heroin, she ultimately decided, okay, you're a grown up. You can have it if you want it. And she gave it to him. And she also supplied the needle. But the issue that the defendant raised on appeal were actually two issues. The first one was the sufficiency of the evidence argument, similar to the argument that the defendant's raising in this appeal. The other was that defense counsel was ineffective for failing to request an instruction on the definition of delivery. So when the defense, when the court considered this issue under the Swiderski rule, they found, as far as the sufficiency of the evidence, even under the facts of that case, a rational jury could have found that she was in possession and delivered the cocaine because she had the cocaine or the, I'm sorry, the heroin in her pocket and exercised exclusive control over it, which was evidenced by the fact that the victim only obtained the heroin that killed him when she decided to ultimately hand it to him, along with the needle that he used to inject it. But on the ineffective assistance of counsel, that's where the court reversed. They said that because the jury was not instructed on delivery, they could have found in favor of the defendant instead. And in the absence of that instruction, made it more likely that they gave more weight to the definition of delivery than they would have otherwise given had they had the instruction. So the court was not did not reverse on the sufficiency question. They reversed on the question of whether counsel's failure to pursue or ask for a jury instruction on the definition of delivery. In this case, the jury was instructed on delivery. And there is no argument that counsel was ineffective for failing to properly instruct the jury. This case is specifically related to the sufficiency of the evidence. And even under Coots, the court found that even that evidence was sufficient. So in this case, the evidence showed that they went together. Rich gave the money to the defendant. The defendant gave the money to the dealer. The dealer gave the cocaine to the defendant, and then the defendant gave the cocaine to Rich. Rich then instructed them to put the cocaine in the cubby in the back seat. The defendant says that they used the cocaine together before they left, and Rich says that they did not. Later in his testimony, the defendant backed up and said, no, Rich was smoking methamphetamine out of a pipe that he had with him. Now, that is a very serious credibility problem because the police, the testimony and the evidence establishes that Rich's vehicle and his person were searched twice. There was no meth pipe found. There was no methamphetamine found. There were no drugs. All of this was before they went to Yorkville. So the question itself that underlies this claim would suggest that the defendant was a joint possessor and that they used this cocaine together, but then later he completely reverses on that statement and says it was methamphetamine and that Rich was smoking it. So, but when Rich took the cocaine, had it put in the cubby in the back seat, Rich says he declined when the defendant said he wanted to use some of the cocaine. The defendant says that they did. That's a credibility question. That doesn't mean under Coots that they were joint users or that they acquired this cocaine for the purpose and the intent to use it together. The defendant points out repeatedly that it was Rich that did this. The defendant gave it to Rich. But what defendant's intent was is not the sole question. The question is what the transaction itself. And in this case, there's no question that Rich did not acquire this cocaine with the defendant because they planned to use it together. Even if defendant could argue that that was his plan, the question of joint possession, it includes, and it says specifically, it is limited to would-be users who jointly and simultaneously acquire jointly together. They acquire it together for the purpose of using it together. So that suggests that the intent of both parties, whoever has joint possession, that there was no intent for him to take possession of it from the defendant and then control what happens to it. So by putting it in the cubby and telling defendant, no, you can't have any, we have to put it in the cubby. And defendant recognized that authority and that control, because otherwise, if they were equal and they both jointly and had control of this, then defendant would have pushed back and said, well, it's half mine. But in this case, the defendant implicitly recognized Rich's control over what happened to those drugs. With turning to the sentencing issue, if there's no questions regarding the Coots case, a large part of the defendant's argument regarding this depends on proving or convincing this court that really all defendant did was give a bag of cocaine to his friend. But the record just doesn't support that. And that would mean that you would have to support this idea that he was a joint possessor and not a deliverer in order to support the argument in the sentencing issue. But overall, his sentence as a Class X was between 6 and 60 years. His sentence of 30 years falls in the middle. The reason the sentence was extended was because of his prior record, his arrest record. It wasn't related to the specific factors. So if the argument regarding the base statutory range of 6 to 30 in this case would play into the question of his specific conduct, but the state disagrees that the specific conduct we're talking about here is not delivery. And the fact that the police ended up with the cocaine in the end does not dispense with the idea that delivery is harmful to the community. If that were the case, then no delivery charge that involved an informant and a controlled buy would ever be able to result in a sentence related to delivery based on harm to the community. And there's no question that these delivery offenses grow and worsen the drug endemic. I believe I'm out of time to address the closing argument issue, but the state maintains that the prosecutor's closing argument accepted that the state's burden of proof was to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty of this crime. The statement the defense counsel is relying on suggests, my time has run. Is it okay if I briefly conclude?
Please.
In closing, the state urges this court to affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal.
Your Honors, I'd like to respond to 2 points, one for issue two, since counsel started with that issue, and then also return to the sufficiency issue, issue one as well. To make it abundantly clear in this case, this was not an accountability case. Accountability was never raised, and it can't be, as Justice Steigman writes in People versus Johnson in 2013, that can't be something that happens now on appeal. So anything that happened in the police report that talks about any sort of legally responsible aspects or facts for the dealer, those wouldn't hurt the delivery case here or even necessarily go to the possession case here. So none of the criminal conduct in this case, because the key fact here is Anglin's possession. Did he have actual possession of the cocaine at any time, or potentially constructive possession, but did he have actual possession? That statement, whether or not he was handed the cocaine, that's not in the police report. That's not on pages 113 to 114 in the common law record, the police report that the state points to. And so whether or
Is
not.
there, I have one clarification question on that point. And is there any dispute that the defendant handed over the cocaine, even if it was for the purpose of use or hiding? Isn't that an agreed upon fact?
Your Honor, I apologize if I made that unclear. In the sufficiency issue, we take the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. So, for the purposes of the sufficiency issue, we accept that Rich's testimony and version of events was true. But it is a disputed fact when it comes to all of the other issues. Whether or not Anglin actually ever touched the drugs is a disputed fact. And that's incredibly critical for this ineffective assistance of counsel case, because as opposing counsel recognizes, whether or not he handled the cocaine, whether he was in that chain at all, is critical to whether or not there was a delivery in this case that involved Anglin. And his accountability for the dealer is just not enough to support this conviction in this case. So potentially, we would still argue that even if there were statements in the police report that said that Anglin touched the cocaine, that still wouldn't be enough to destroy the value of this impeachment evidence. It wouldn't be a strategic decision to forego this 2023 methamphetamine arrest, especially given the fact that the state went and said that Rich is just someone doing good deeds for the police. He has no reason, no motive to lie in this case. None has been established. Well, it was incumbent upon counsel to establish every critical fact that would impeach Rich, who was a critical witness in this case. And People versus
So I
Miles.
Had a question I wish to follow up on about you're raising the trial counsel's failure to cross-examine Rich about the new methamphetamine charge as an instance of ineffective assistance of counsel, are you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. There's two prongs involved in that analysis. The first is have to show its deficient performance, but the second, which also has to be shown, is prejudice, which means that we would have to conclude that there's a reasonable probability that but for the error of not pursuing, not revealing this arrest, the outcome of trial would have been different. Now, how, on this record, how in the world could this seemingly minor matter, which, as I commented, maybe can dirty up Rich a bit, but there's rehabilitative elements available as well. How in the world could that be sufficient to establish a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different had he pursued this line?
Your Honor, it would be significant because of that critical fact that we talked about, whether or not Anglin actually ever possessed it. And that's something that is only testified to by Seth Rich. The police in this case did not see the transaction. They just saw the dealer come to the door of the car. So whether or not Anglin participated in this delivery, whether or not he possessed the cocaine at all, whether or not Seth Rich just said he possessed the cocaine, but really the dealer came and then they put it in the back cubbyhole, Anglin didn't even know what was going on. You don't have to accept Anglin's version of events to discount Rich's version of events. Those two things, it's not an either or situation. As we discussed at length when we were talking about it originally, the burden is on the state. So the jury, knowing that Seth Rich wasn't just doing this, could decide that Seth Rich was not just doing good deeds if they knew that he didn't just have this 2020 methamphetamine conviction, but he also had a 2023 methamphetamine arrest to show that he is continuing to interact with drugs, not just as a police informant, but in his personal capacity. I see that I do not have much time left, so I will leave it at that and rest on my briefs and what I argued in the opening. Thank you.
Counsel, I just want to mention, I thought you both did a nice job in oral argument. It was Gaulish. Particularly, I want to thank you for responding to my questions. You did a nice job of that. And all too often, this court doesn't get direct answers, and you did a nice job.
Thank you.
Okay, no further questions. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement and is in recess.